From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The last debate's history. 3 weeks to go. Hello again, I'm Orrin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. John McCain came out swinging last night on taxes, health care, and Barack Obama's alleged association with 60s anti-war extremist Bill Ayers. In what's being called the most intense, spirited, and combative of their three debates, Obama maintained what one paper labeled amused detachment. With so little time left, did it make any difference? Did McCain successfully separate himself from President Bush? Did Obama stay ahead by staying cool? What about the economy? We'll hear from strategists on both sides and get reaction from battleground states Virginia, Ohio, and Indiana. On Reporter's Notebook later on, same-sex marriage and Roman Catholics in California. First, the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Orrin Olney back with To the Point. The last debate of this year's presidential campaign was the liveliest, but with 3 weeks to go, did it make any difference? We'll hear from Republican and Democratic strategists, and we'll get a reaction from Indiana, Virginia, and Ohio, states that could make the difference on Election Day. On Reporter's Notebook, a Roman Catholic priest fired in California for defying church teaching on same-sex marriage. First, this news update. At Camp David this coming weekend, President Bush will meet with French President Nicolas Sarkozy, who has a mandate from the other leaders of the European Union: reconstruct the global financial system for the 21st century. Krishna Guha is chief U.S. economic correspondent for the Financial Times. Thanks very much for being with us.
My great pleasure.
The finance minister of Spain says this is a crisis that comes from the United States. It's a crisis we're going to overcome thanks to the European Union. What are the Europeans looking for?
Well, I think, you know, everybody wants to blame somebody else for this crisis, don't they? And clearly the Europeans are, you know, frustrated and angry in some respects at the nature of the origins of this in the subprime market and the housing market in the U.S. and with some of the policy decisions by the U.S. government, in particular the failure of Lehman Brothers, which helped to precipitate the last few weeks of intense financial stress. But really, the trip by the European leaders at the weekend isn't really about a blame game. It's about a European belief that we now really need to start rebuilding a new architecture for the global financial system. We need institutions to be reformed, like the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and others, to make sure that we're really on top of these financial stability issues for the long haul.
Do the IMF and the World Bank have anything to do then with international stability? Is that something that most people don't really know about?
Well, you see, back in the post-war period, when we had the so-called Bretton Woods agreement, we created institutions like the World Bank, the IMF, and also the forerunner of the World Trade Organization. The idea was to create international, or in the jargon, multilateral institutions that would keep an eye on things. The International Monetary Fund would look at exchange rate and monetary issues. The World Bank would look at development and reconstruction, and the trade bodies would promote trade talks. The world system has really outgrown these institutions. Private markets have become so big, they've become so sophisticated, and the nature of dangers and crises that we face today are really very different from the ones not just that we faced, you know, in the 40s and 50s and 60s, but even from the crises of the 1990s. So what the European leaders are saying is we really need to start over to recreate institutions. Prime Minister Brown from the UK wants, for instance, to give the IMF a clear mandate to act as an early warning signal, to provide early warning signals when there are financial dangers building in the international system. These are the kind of ideas the Europeans want to discuss with the U.S.
Apparently, Washington is less enthusiastic than the Europeans.
Well, I think that does indeed appear to be the case. I think there's probably two reasons for that. One is that the Europeans don't seem to have grasped the fact that they want to hold a summit in November or December, which is completely the wrong time to do it from a U.S. perspective, in the middle of the, you know, the transition from the Bush administration to whoever comes next. So the timing is all wrong from a U.S. perspective. But also, I think the U.S. authorities are just wary of, you know, jumping to conclusions in the middle of this crisis. I think people here understand that we need to revisit a lot of these issues, but perhaps would want to do this maybe with cooler heads, you know, when the crisis, the immediate crisis, has been dealt with. And I think there's also, you know, global governance proposals, while actually not necessarily as scary as they sound, are always treated with a little bit more skepticism here in the U.S. than in Europe, where nations are used to cooperating through institutions, in particular of the European Union itself.
Talking with Krishna Guha, who's the chief U.S. economic correspondent for the Financial Times. In the meantime, just to bring people up to date, the Dow Jones Industrial Average bounced around quite a lot today. A little early to tell where it is. It seems to be about even at the moment. But in Japan, the markets went down 11%. In Europe, they went down a roughly an average of 5%. So there's still plenty to worry about.
Oh, yes, there is. I mean, the markets appear to be now focused on the risk of really quite a deep global recession. The measures announced by the governments on both sides of the Atlantic in recent days to rescue the banking system, you know, putting this $250 billion into the U.S. banks, for instance, in a sense, removes the sort of specific danger that a large number of the most important banks could collapse in the coming weeks and months, which looked quite possible only a few weeks ago. But it really doesn't do anything in the near term to improve the prospects for the economy. And those look very grim indeed, not just in the U.S., but across many of the industrialized economies of the world.
I assume, too, that reforming the IMF, the World Bank, or perhaps even the World Trade Organization wouldn't have any immediate effect on the economy either.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, these institutions may have some, you know, useful roles to play in our near-term crisis management. I mean, the IMF offers some smart, intelligent sort of advice to some nations about policy options. The World Bank obviously is trying to help some of the developing countries that are caught up in this problem. The IMF may be able to offer balance of payments loans for emerging economies with facing financial distress. Some people think that starting a new trade round, or rather reviving the Doha trade round, would help to improve confidence. But really, these are the sort of near-term issues. The questions the Europeans are now raising are the longer range. You know, how do we design a world in which these kind of disasters are less likely to happen?
We'll see what happens at Camp David. Thank you very much, Krishna Guha with the Financial Times. In the moment, the last debate on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, we're not only back with To the Point. In the depths of an economic crisis, recent polls show that attacks are backfiring on John McCain, but the message from his Republican base was to come out swinging. One question was whether he'd mentioned Bill Ayers, the anti-war extremist from the Vietnam era. He did.
Mr. Ayers, I don't care about an old washed-up terrorist, but as Senator Clinton said in her debates with you, we need to know the full extent of that relationship.
Obama had a response.
I think the fact that this has become such an important part of your campaign, Senator McCain, says more about your campaign than it says about me.
One place where the Ayers Association has been used against Obama is Virginia, where the Republican chairman has likened Obama to Osama bin Laden. Jeff Shapiro is political reporter for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Do you think that this is what Virginia voters wanted to hear, those who Senator McCain needs to get on his side in order to win?
Well, certainly the base is welcoming this sort of rhetoric. Remember that Senator McCain had some difficulty with his party just in terms of general enthusiasm until Governor Palin was suggested, and that was installed as the vice presidential nominee, and that was certainly the case here in Virginia. So this is coming across as red meat.
Now, Virginia is a state that used to be pretty reliably Republican in presidential elections. Not so much the case, it looks like, this year.
Virginia usually defaults Republican at the presidential level. The last time a Democrat won this state was 1964, Lyndon Johnson, on the strength of a newly enfranchised African-American vote. But a good deal has happened over the succeeding 44 years, and more specifically over the past 7 years, the Democrats have really come back strongly, twice winning the governorship, knocking off an incumbent Republican United States Senator, George Allen, who was running for president, and then also taking back the state Senate. So there's been a good deal of forward momentum for the Democrats, and both parties acknowledge that is a sign that this play is this state is very much in play.
Was the debate last night, do you think, potentially important in Virginia, or does the fact that Obama has so much more in resources add up to a much more important factor?
Senator Obama has pulled out the stops in Virginia, and this is something that he has been doing constantly and consistently for months now, aided in large part by the state's Democratic governor, Tim Kaine, who was the first governor outside of Illinois and the first Southern politician of note to endorse his candidacy. Governor Kaine endorsed the senator barely a week after Senator Obama announced for president. So there's a good deal of political machinery at work here in Virginia, and that coupled with some very significant changes in the profile electorate, as well as dramatic growth in the electorate, means this state is very much up for grabs.
Well, Jeff Shapiro, a political reporter, columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's go to another state, which is very important to the campaign and to both campaigns, I should say, and in a surprising way, and that's Indiana. Mary Beth Schneider is state government reporter for the Indianapolis Star. Mary Beth Schneider, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
What did you hear last night that you thought might make a difference in Indiana?
I'm not sure I heard anything last night that might make a difference in Indiana, but the fact that we're even talking about Indiana tells you how what bad shape, frankly, John McCain's campaign is in. We are never a battleground state. No one remotely thinks of us as one. When I was at the Republican convention, I was talking to top people in the Republican Party who scoffed at the idea that Barack Obama was spending so much time and money here. And lo and behold, now that John McCain is having to put time and money here, his running mate Sarah Palin is here tomorrow. Like Virginia, Indiana has not gone for Republicans since 1964. Only four times in this century has a Democrat won Indiana. Republicans can take it for granted most of the time, not this year. And the reasons are the same as everywhere. And the economy has really hurt people. People are scared about what's happening to their 401ks. But there's also another reason, and that's that we had a prolonged primary season this year with the Democrats. So our primary is in May, and to have Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in here, visit after visit after visit, the state was exposed to a Democrat presidential message in a way they never have been before, and a grassroots organization was created that Obama's been able to use. McCain still has probably the advantage here, but not by much.
Again, Mary Beth Schneider, state government reporter for the Indianapolis Star. Did McCain do enough to separate himself from President Bush? Let's listen to this exchange.
Senator Obama, I am not President Bush. If you wanted to run against President Bush, you should have run 4 years ago. I'm going to give a new direction to this economy in this country.
Now, you've shown independence, commendable independence, on some key issues like torture, for example. And I give you enormous credit for that. But when it comes to economic policies, essentially what you are proposing is eight more years of the same thing.
Back to Mary Beth Schneider with the Indianapolis Star. Does that exchange, does that effort by McCain to separate himself from President Bush, is that something that's going to be good for him in Indiana?
It's anything that he can do to separate himself from President Bush is good for him anywhere. Of many states, I suppose President Bush might be a little bit more popular in states like Indiana. But Senator McCain, if you'd continued to play that clip, he did not have a very good answer coming back. And I've seen the Obama campaign already today has an ad out using that exchange. And so while perhaps maybe if Senator McCain early on had made more of the case of I am not President Bush, it's awfully late in the day, and it's pretty funny to have, I guess, the Obama campaign being the ones that are running that ad now.
Already an ad on television in Indiana after a debate that occurred less than 24 hours ago, or roughly 12 hours ago.
Yes.
That's pretty fast, and suggests the way that this the dynamics of this campaign are different from past campaigns. Jonathan Riskind is Washington bureau chief for the Columbus Dispatch. Spends a lot of time in Ohio, another of the battleground states, big one. Jonathan Riskind, good to have you back on our program.
It's always great to be with you, Warren.
What did you hear last night that you think might make a difference in Ohio?
Well, there was Joe the Plumber, Joe the Plumber, and Joe the Plumber. At least that's what John McCain hopes will make a difference in Ohio. I think by one count, he may have invoked Joe the Plumber's name something like 20 times. So I think
26, McCain, I saw in one count.
Well, I may have lost track, I'll admit. Clearly what John McCain was trying to do was get to working-class Ohioans on the tax issue. That's always been an issue Republicans believe they can make inroads on in Ohio, but just as clearly, I think Obama believes he's making inroads on the economy and what he says are his plans for middle class tax cuts and his proposals that he says he at least asserts will help the middle class more than John McCain's. At this point, Obama is up in most polls that have been taken, not by a ton. Some polls 6 or 7 points, most polls 3 or 4 points. He is up in Ohio, a state that famously George Bush won in 2004 as well as 2000.
Now, Joe the Plumber, for those who didn't see the debate or haven't read the papers, was a guy in Ohio, as I recall, who approached Obama and said that according to his tax plan, if, in fact, he made more than $250,000 and was subject to new taxes, he wouldn't be able to buy the plumbing business that he was setting out for. I don't know how clearly McCain explained that connection when he brought it up. But as you said, there was an awful lot of talk about Joe the Plumber afterwards.
Yeah, and apparently Joe the Plumber lives near Toledo up in the northwest corner of the state. And I have not done personal reporting on this, I will confess. But from what I understand, Joe the Plumber now has said that he actually would not be at that 200,000 plus individual level or 250,000 family level yet to pay those taxes. So I think the story of Joe the Plumber will go on. But in the end, I'm not sure Joe the Plumber is going to make a big impact in Ohio one way or the other. I suspect that McCain is facing a tough circumstance there with the economy, as he is in a number of other swing states.
Joe the Plumber himself, having been interviewed now by practically every television outlet in the United States, says that he's happy to be well known, and perhaps it'll even do him some good in his business. David Winston again with Jonathan Riskind with the Columbus Dispatch. Our next guest is David Winston. He's a Republican pollster and strategist, also columnist for Roll Call, election analyst with CBS, and director of planning under the House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Good to have you back on our program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
What did you think yesterday that McCain was going to have to do in order to start to make a difference, cut into Obama's lead, and did he in fact do it?
Well, there were two big things that I think he made some progress, and obviously the question is, was it enough, and is there enough time? The two were, one, getting people to understand what a John McCain economic policy would look like, and what he tried to do with Joe the Plumber was put a face on that. I mean, what that actually looked like. The level of success he has, we'll see how that plays out over the next couple of days. But I think he was at least able to assert that. The other element, as the woman from Indiana was saying, was this separation from Bush, that he had to clearly define himself going in a different direction. Bush's job disapprovals at 70%, and that's obviously something that's made the McCain campaign have some difficult times, and so making that separation was important. In both cases, I don't know, he needed to make that more repetitious during the whole course of the debate, in terms of constantly saying, I'm different than Bush, and constantly reasserting, although I think he did a better job with Joe the Plumber, as you said, 26 times. That was a lot of times. But those are the two important things. We'll see what he does when he gets back out on the campaign trail. If he can reassert those two items, that'll help. The other things that began to occur, though, within the debate is he got sidetracked off onto other side debates as opposed to focusing on those two items. And I think they were a distraction during the course of the debate, Ayers being an example.
I heard a little bit of his speech today in Pennsylvania. And he referred to the head of the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, who has said she doesn't understand why it isn't that they're paying more attention to helping people pay their mortgages. And Senator McCain made a big point about that today, emphasized that it ought not to be Wall Street and the bankers that get all the help. Of course, he voted for the $700 billion bailout. But is that, Dave Winston, is that something he ought to be doing? Is that a good thing as far as the
direction he needs to be going in, and in the sense of, again, putting a face on it, talking about how he's going to help people solve their specific family problems in terms of what's happening in terms of the economy. That's a direction he, quite frankly, should have been taking from the summer forward. One of the problems that he now finds himself in is that, look, when the margin nationally gets to be 4, 5, 6 points, this is not state by state anymore. I mean, Bill Clinton in 1996 won by 5 points and got 379 electoral votes, which is why it's interesting the group of states you just hit on. Again, I can't remember her name, the woman from Indiana. She's absolutely right. The fact that we're talking about Indiana is not a good sign for the McCain campaign. The fact that we're talking about Virginia and North Carolina, it also shows you the trouble they're in. Having said that, what McCain's talking about now is what he needs to be talking about. The question is just, is there enough time, and can he be forceful enough with it and stay off the other topics and really focus in on just those two, the economy and separating himself from Bush?
We're talking with David Winston, who is a Republican pollster and strategist. Our guest from the Indianapolis Star is Mary Beth Schneider, and we'll get back to her a little later. First, I want to introduce Ed Kilgore, who's managing editor of the Democratic Strategist. That's an online magazine devoted to the long-range challenges facing the Democratic Party. And Ed Kilgore, always good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
There are those who describe Senator Obama's demeanor last night as amused detachment. Is that an accurate description, do you think, and is that all he needed to convey in order to simply stay ahead by staying cool?
Yeah, I mean, the metaphor I've been using is this sort of Muhammad Ali's rope-a-dope strategy. You know, he's ahead. John McCain is in this terrible position where he's being advised by some people to go on the attack, advised by other people to somehow come up with a miraculous new economic proposal. You know, John McCain is not at his best when he's angry and combative. So I think it made abundant good sense, particularly when McCain was going into either really outworn attack lines like this silly vote for the budget resolution, or the AIRS stuff, which most people don't even care about. I think bemused detachment's not a bad idea. And, you know, I think it's pretty clear by now, having gone through three of these debates, in which a lot of the pundits said McCain won on points, but the public felt very strongly otherwise, that Obama's doing something right.
So the polls have indicated then, the ones that you believe anyway, that Obama was the one who really scored with the viewers.
That seems to be the case, and I mean, my personal theory all along, even from the first debate, is that, you know, the debates aren't driving public opinion right now, they're reflecting it. And I think all along, people have begun to make up their minds, they're increasingly viewing the debates through the prism of their own candidate preferences. And finally, you know, I think this was particularly pertinent last night, the old conservative talking points, you know, that tax cuts, Uber Alles, deregulation. I mean, they just don't have much punch anymore.
Ed Kilgore, hold that thought. We're going to take a break and come right back on Reporter's Notebook. A Roman Catholic priest fired in California for defying church teaching on same-sex marriage. This is To the Point.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, to talking about the aftermath of last night's debate, talked about the debate itself, talked about a bit about how it's coming down, went down, and what the dynamic is in Virginia, in Ohio, and in Indiana, swing states, all of them unusually so, particularly Indiana and Virginia this time around. Steve Kornacki is political columnist for the New York Observer. And, Steve, good to have you back on our program.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
What do you think we're going to see in the next 3 weeks?
Well, I mean, I think we have to be sort of honest if we're going to do an objective analysis here and say this, you know, at this point, barring something, you know, miraculous and utterly unprecedented in the modern era, we're not talking about who's going to win the presidential race. We're talking about how much Barack Obama is going to win it by and how far down the ballot it's going to reverberate. I really think John McCain's position, we've hit on this, some of the other guests that have hit on this theme, John McCain's position now really calls to mind where Bob Dole was at this point in 1996, where Walter Mondale, in a way, was in 1984, guys who, toward the end of the campaign, had no chance of winning, and their goal became to try to consolidate their party base and not to lose too badly and not to take out the entire, you know, their entire down-the-ballot running mates. Dole had some success with that in 96. He spent the last week of the campaign, he was in places like South Dakota, where Republicans should never have to campaign. Mondale obviously had no success with that and basically lost every state. If you look at the strategic decisions that the McCain people are making now, pulling out of Michigan 2 weeks ago, pulling out of Wisconsin yesterday, pulling out of Maine yesterday, consolidating resources into North Carolina, a state that really even hasn't been competitive at the presidential level since 1976, this is very reminiscent of where the Republicans were in 1996. And Bob Dole was able to succeed in winning 159 electoral votes, you know, lost by 8 points, but at least there was something respectable in that. I mean, we're talking about the potential now for 60 seats for the Democrats in the U.S. Senate, a pickup of two dozen House seats. This could get very ugly for the Republicans, and I think they're aware of that, and they're trying to sort of keep it in check.
Bob Dole and Walter Mondale are both challengers. Dole challenging Clinton in 1966, Mondale challenging Reagan in 1984. Well, does this idea of shoring up the base put special attention back on the vice presidential choice, Sarah Palin?
Well, the Palin thing is interesting to me because, you know, I've heard this debate now for the last, really since she was picked, about, you know, was she a good pick or was she not a good pick? And depending on who you talk to, she was either the most, you know, brilliant political decision ever or, you know, Dan Quayle revisited. I think she, in a way, she's both simultaneously. The argument that's made that she was a good pick is, you know, that obviously she fired up the base and she energized the Republican faithful and all of these things. And it's true and it's undeniable and there's something to be said for that. Although I do think that even though the Republican base wasn't originally that or has never really been that enamored of John McCain, they have really they've really developed a strong dislike and distrust for Barack Obama. You're seeing that in these crowds that are making news now in the last 2 weeks, shouting, you know, all sorts of things about him. So I always kind of question, you know, how much danger McCain was in with the base once they sort of developed this strong distaste for Obama. Would they hold their nose and vote for McCain anyway? But if you get beyond the Republican base, then the other question is independent voters, swing voters, the ones who always decide elections. And while Palin's going over very well with the base, among the critical voters who really decide elections, she's going over terribly. And it's gotten worse and worse as the campaign has gone on. And we saw this in a New York Times poll that came out yesterday. She's a clear liability for John McCain when it comes to swing voters. Raises all sorts of questions about his judgment, about the idea of if anything happens to him, do we want this woman to be president of the United States? Is she ready to be? It's been a disastrous pick with independent voters, and I think it's another. McCain's just been in a very tough situation where he's had so many built-in disadvantages with the Bush presidency, with the state of the economy, with the wars, particularly in Iraq. This is just another area where he's given independent voters, he's put up an obstacle for independent voters to sort of shrug and vote for him anyway. And he really could not afford any more obstacles with all that he was already dealing with.
Steve Kornacki, again, a political columnist for the New York Observer. Let me go back to Mary Beth Schneider, state government reporter for the Indianapolis Star. How does this sound in the state of Indiana, so Republican that, as you said earlier, no Republican candidate for president should ever have to campaign there, and this was the first primary that they really got a look at any Democrats because it took so long. What about the impact on the whole state of this campaign, and does Sarah Palin help to make things better in Indiana for the Republicans?
Well, I think they're clearly hoping that she does. She is very popular among the base, and one concern that Republicans had was that the base was going to stay home and it was going to impact other races. So they're hoping that this excites at least those people to get out and help them win some other races. Tomorrow when she's here, some of the other candidates for attorney general and superintendent of public instruction are going to be there with her. Obviously, they think that's a good place for them to be. But this is also a real ticket-splitting state. Back when Dan Quayle was on the ticket for vice president, a Democrat, Evan Bayh, was winning for governor in a big way. And so most people don't really think that whatever happens on the presidential race, it'll have too much impact, at least on high-profile races. But on lesser-profile races, yeah, it could have a real impact, and she helps there.
Okay, Dan Quayle, former vice president, of course, from the state of Indiana. Mary Beth Schneider, thanks a lot for being with us.
Sure.
Reporter for the Indianapolis Star. Jonathan Riskin still with us, Washington bureau chief of the Columbus Dispatch. What about Ohio? Is Sarah Palin going to be seen there a lot?
I think she will be seen there in places like Southeast Ohio, Appalachian Ohio, rural Ohio, where I think she is very popular with the Republican base, and also potentially with sort of culturally conservative, socially conservative Democrats in those areas. Those are areas where Hillary Clinton really beat Barack Obama pretty badly in the primary. I mean, obviously Hillary Clinton won the state overall in the primary, but in those areas in particular, Hillary Clinton ran up big totals. So I think you will see Palin there. I just to pick up on another point real quickly, the interesting thing about Ohio is that I think it no longer is a state that Obama has to win. I mean, he's playing ball, so to speak, in so many other places that, yes, if he wins Ohio, it's probably pretty much over. But he can put himself over the top, so to speak, electorally in so many other places, and he's playing playing in so many other places that Ohio has turned into a place that McCain has to win, but that Obama doesn't have to win.
No question, though, about McCain. He's got to have – any Republican really has to have Ohio, right?
Well, because McCain's electoral map has really not advanced beyond where Bush's was, but Obama's has. I mean, he's ahead in places, as you noted, like Virginia and perhaps even North Carolina, in Colorado. So he's got all these other states that he appears on the verge, at least, of picking up, or has a good chance of picking up. And he's now supposedly ahead in Florida, or at least it's very close in Florida. His electoral map has expanded greatly, whereas McCain's has not.
Well, Jonathan Riskin, it's always good to have you on our program.
It's always great to be with you.
Washington bureau chief of the Columbus Dispatch. David Winston, still with us, Republican pollster and a strategist, columnist for Roll Call, formerly on the staff of the former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Is this right, what we're hearing? Was Steve Kornacki right that the question is not who's going to win, but how much?
Well, I think McCain is making his last best effort in terms of trying to talk about the economy and separate himself from Bush. I mean, it is clearly an uphill battle. I'd sort of, if you want to put it in a sports analogy, it's sort of like being down 3-1 in the World Series. You still have a shot, but you're going to have to do everything perfectly. I think there's another element here in terms of having people look at this race and what's going on that is much longer-term structurally important. What happened in 2006 to the Republicans is basically the center-right majority that Gingrich and Reagan had put together fell apart. And the best example of that was we lost independents by 18 points. Well, you can't sustain a majority losing independents by 18 points. Independents actually happen to be a center-right group, and there are a variety of other groups that were like that as well, married women with children, Catholics, middle income. The challenge of the McCain campaign was not the base. It was how do you rebuild this center-right majority? And at this point, I mean, they have struggled. I mean, they have focused on the base to the exclusion of those other center-right groups. And the challenge now is, do they have enough time, given these two particular issues, separating themselves from Bush and the economy, to sort of rebuild that coalition? It's a pretty tall order.
Ed Kilgore is still with us, managing editor of the Democratic Strategist, talking about the long-term challenges for the party. Has Barack Obama managed, do you think, to appeal to that center-right group, if that's in fact what independents are, pretty much by being cautious and as we heard earlier, remaining amusedly detached in confrontations such as the one last night?
Well, I mean, I think Barack Obama has sold himself very effectively to swing voters. There's nothing about his demeanor or to tell you the truth, about his record that would be particularly alarming to people. And as David pointed out, we're really dealing with a different electorate than we had in 2006. If you look at the registration numbers, if you look at early voting, you know, this is a it may be the same folks, but it's a different electorate than it was in 2004. Something else I'd like to say about McCain, though, that I haven't heard anybody else say, there's been a deep-seated belief among conservatives for a long time that the reason George W. Bush failed was that he wasn't conservative enough. He didn't deploy enough troops in Iraq. He didn't control spending, didn't even cut taxes enough, didn't fight for cultural issues like abortion. And part of the, you know, really difficult game John McCain's been playing all year long is to be a maverick while appealing to the base. And I think we saw it again last night. You know, challenged to identify where he differs from George W. Bush, he's either silent or he says he'll even be more conservative. And it isn't working.
So the question then is, for him, how does he unify that party? David Winston, isn't that right? The party itself is fundamentally divided.
No, and I think one of the dynamics that is the challenge of McCain or any Republican at this point is, again, how do you build a majority coalition? Inherently, what's implied in that is you have people with differing views, and how you put that together and how you manage that is critical. One of the things that you saw Bill Clinton do when he was president, being a sort of centrist president, dealing with the far left of his party, he was able to figure out how to balance those interests. That's the challenge. The dynamic here is that neither party's base is anywhere near large enough to just generate an outright win. And so ultimately, what you defined there, Warren, was exactly the problem facing the campaign that so far they've struggled with, mm-hmm. and that is, how do you create that coalition so everybody feels their interests are fairly represented?
Let me go back to Steve Kornacki, the political columnist for the New York Observer, and ask you this. You say that you're the one who said that, barring a miracle, the question is not who's going to win, but how much is Obama going to win by. Of course, and particularly if he takes 60 or brings with him 60 seats in the Senate, filibuster-proof majority, and gets 24 more in the House, he's going to be talking about a mandate. The question would be then, it seems to me, a mandate for what? What have we heard from Obama that we could safely say would be what he has a mandate to do?
Yeah, well, I mean, we talk about the situation, too, that the Republican Party's in right now. And, I mean, there's great opportunity for both parties if this is a wipeout if the Democrats have a just decisive win in November. You think back to if he gets to 60 seats in the Senate, let's say, and he takes in, I don't know, 20 new House seats and wins just overwhelmingly, it would call to mind immediately what happened with Ronald Reagan in 1980 when Ronald Reagan brought in 12 new senators on Election Day, and it almost was 15 if you looked at the races that they just missed on. I mean, unbelievable turn in the U.S. Senate, and Reagan walked into this awful economic situation. You know, inflation was double digits, unemployment was way up, interest rates were about 20%, and, you know, his mandate was to come in and cut taxes and get the economy going again. History remembers him as sort of having succeeded, at least in the short term. But if you really look back at what happened to Ronald Reagan, the first 2 years of his administration were hell. The economy went right. It was already in rough shape. It went right into a recession in 1981 and 1982. And the Republicans, got bloodied in the 1982 elections, so much that all sorts of Democrats emerged to run against Reagan in 1984. A lot of people thought he was going to be a one-term president, and obviously it turned out differently. The Republicans, the comparison I'm trying to make here is the Republicans, you know, could well find themselves in the same situation after this election. They lose everything. They have to come up with new leaders, new faces, new definition of who they are and what they are. Are they the party of democratizing foreign policy, or are they realists again? They used to be the party of Wall Street. You know, Wall Street doesn't exist anymore, so they have to redefine themselves. They'll have new faces, and given where the economy stands right now, Obama can't just come in and wave a magic wand. If it doesn't turn around right away, he's going to get a lot of blame. His party's going to get a lot of blame, and the Republicans will have an opportunity starting in 2010 to start building their numbers back and to start to redefine who they are.
So, Ed Kilgore, back to you, our Democrat. What do we know from the campaign so far that Obama could do with big majorities, given the economic situation he will face, in order to hold on to power, even for past the first 2 years?
Well, I think he has to be careful. He has to manage expectations. I personally think he needs a large Reform Washington initiative. It won't really cost a whole lot of money, the minute he takes office, something to do with public financing of campaigns, maybe even redistricting reform, something that that mobilizes the mass of people in both parties that want to see fundamental change in Washington and that maintains his momentum from the campaign. Then he's got to pick and choose very carefully among big priorities, other than whatever he has to do to immediately respond to the economic situation. I suspect health care reform may be the first biggie.
When you say public financing, he's a little weak on that one, isn't he, in as much as he turned it down?
Well, the presidential financing system, as I think anybody knows who's looked at it carefully, is a big mess. He's consistently supported public financing of congressional elections. And I do think he's got to overcome the problem that afflicted Bill Clinton when he took office in 1993, a sense of immediate disappointment and lowered expectations in the sense that this is just another politician. Mm-hmm. So I think he really does have to keep the momentum going. And from a substantive point of view, there really aren't any Democrats that have an issue with that. So I think he does have a huge window of opportunity. And I think just because of the historic nature of his candidacy and the possible magnitude of his victory, he may very well have the kind of honeymoon that we haven't seen in a while.
David Winston, back to you, our Republican. Would the Republicans use this as an opportunity, as Dave Kornacki suggested, to make it very difficult for Obama, or would they take the view that the economy is in such shape, the nation is in such shape, that they better get on board and try to assist in making things right rather than trying to stymie a president who has, presumably, we're making this assumption now, and it certainly hasn't happened, has won with a big majority?
Well, first of all, I'm not completely ready to raise the white flag here in terms of surrender here. I mean, I do think, again, we do have a couple of weeks to go. And John McCain, I mean, if you were going to get him to focus on two things in terms of separating himself from Bush and the economy, that's obviously the best opportunity. But I think what you're driving at, Warren, is that there's a broader question here. And when people talk about change, there's actually another element to this. What people are really tired of, and looking at lots of polls, and I think you'll find general agreement in terms of the other participants as well here, is that people are just really tired of this partisanship. And so I think one of the challenges to whomever walks into the White House is really restructuring how political discourse and political debates occur, because what people sort of feel is the parties are sort of out for themselves and not necessarily for the individual voters. And that's a dynamic that I think you'll see either one, whoever gets there, has to address.
All right. David Winston, our Republican pollster, formerly with House Speaker Gingrich, a columnist for Roll Call, election analyst, an analyst for CBS News. Ed Kilgore, managing editor of the Democratic Strategist online magazine. Steve Kornacki, the political columnist for the New York Observer. Good to have all of you with us. And thanks to Jonathan Nariskin of the Columbus Dispatch and Mary Beth Schneider of the Indianapolis Star as well. A Roman Catholic priest has been removed from his job and stripped of his salary for supporting same-sex marriage in California. Well, in a moment, we'll ask why he defied the church's teachings on a very controversial ballot measure. To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To the Point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In California next month, voters will be asked to overturn the state Supreme Court's ruling that gays and lesbians have the constitutional right to be married. Proposition 8 would establish that marriage can only occur between a man and a woman. The Roman Catholic Church is supporting the measure, and it has effectively fired Father Jeffrey Farrow, who defied church teaching in a sermon last week in the inland city of Fresno. Father Jeffrey Farrow, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Warren.
The Bishop of Fresno, Bishop Steinbach, has said your statement contradicted the teaching of the Catholic Church and brought scandal to your parish community as well as the whole church. What did you say, and why did you say it?
Well, essentially what I did was to quote what the church itself says. In 1975, in a statement on sexual ethics, the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, which is the watchdog for orthodoxy for the Catholic Church, said that there are people who are born with an innate homosexual orientation. So the church is basically saying that there are people that God made this way. And that what I said from the pulpit on Sunday is nothing really radically different than what many priests say to their parishioners, to their congregants, in the confessional or in counseling sessions. And that is to try to guide them so that they can have a whole life. I think the parallel would be the church's ban on contraception. And most priests basically try to guide heterosexual couples so they can live a life, you know, and have that, and or divorced and remarried Catholics. And so there's a disconnect between the official doctrinal statements on some of these points and the pastoral practice. And I believe that in the case of same-sex couples or individuals that, as the church says, have this innate orientation, there needs to be an honest and frank discussion within the church, and we need to minister to these people openly and in the light. And I think that day's come.
So the doctrine is that homosexuality is innate. It's something that God created, you're saying, but pastoral practice requires that only a man and a woman can be married.
Well, what happens in, the official the official teaching is only a man and a woman can be married, but that creates a problem. I mean, most of us, it was in adolescence that we discovered our orientation. And at that same point in life, what is happening is that what kids are hearing from the church is basically silence on this matter, and that, you know, you can't get married, so what options does a kid have? And that they hear this is disordered and all this other stuff. And so that creates issues. The Center for Disease Control says 33% of adolescent gay kids consider suicide. They don't speak to their parents. They're afraid to talk. There's an increased incidence of alcohol and drug abuse. And so for me, as a pastor, this is not a political issue or even one of civil rights, although those are also considerations. But this is a human issue. I mean, we have a pastoral responsibility to the people in the pews to help them. And the cost of not being honest, the cost of not talking about this, of not offering guidance, is astronomical in the sense of human lives, broken families, and tragedy, sometimes even suicide.
And you yourself are homosexual, as you intimated a moment ago, and as you said in a television interview, actually before you delivered the sermon, is that right?
Yeah, the journalist asked me the question everybody wants to know, are you gay? And I said, I prefaced my answer by saying it's a secondary issue, because this is not about me, this is about this issue. It's a secondary issue, but yes, I am. You know, it's something that I thought was going to be the secret I was going to take to my grave, and it was in seminary, in graduate school, that my spiritual director said, you know, until you come to peace with this, you can't really serve other people in ministry, and basically encouraged me to you know, to not be ashamed of this, to accept, you know, who I am as God made me. But I guess I'm lucky in that I had a loving and supportive family and was in an institution like the seminary where I had that support system, but a lot of kids don't.
One of the things you said in your sermon was, or one of the questions you asked specifically about Proposition 8, which once again would redefine marriage in California and require that it only be between a man and a woman, you said, how is marriage protected by intimidating gay and lesbian people into loveless and lonely lives? Very consistent with what you have just said. What kind of reaction did you get from your parishioners at Fresno, principally people associated with the academic community there with the Fresno State University?
Well, you know, I was surprised at the end of that statement. Many, many people in the church stood up and applauded. I honestly, that took me by surprise. Subsequently, I've had parishioners email me and contact me and express their gratitude for my having spoken candidly and openly about this. I've been the generosity and the goodness of people has overwhelmed me. Various people offered me the use of their home, if I needed any financial help. Some people have come forward and been very good. And honestly, you know, the Lord said that whoever gives up house or family for me will receive 100-fold, and I found that to be the case with my parishioners. They've been very loving, very supportive. I mean, there have been a few people that took exception. I think one gentleman was upset because this subject was mentioned in the presence of children. I thought, you know, good God, in the gospel, which is read at Mass, Jesus talks about adulterers and prostitutes. How is this any more scandalous than that? And if you can't hear about it in church on Sunday, you may be shocked to hear about it in your house from your kids. And so, again, Jesus said the truth sets you free, and I think we need to be honest about this subject.
We have a very short time left, I'm sorry to say. You also said in your sermon, "I know these words of truth will cost me dearly." Subsequently, you were removed from your job by the Bishop of Fresno and deprived of your salary and benefits. Do you expect to be removed as a priest?
Well, your crystal ball is as good as mine, and I don't know. I mean, that's something that has been implied could occur. It's a judicial process within the church, and I am represented by a canon lawyer. So we'll see how that plays out. One of the things that was implied was I should remain silent, not speak to the media, et cetera. So speaking to you today is probably not a good career move. But the reason I'm speaking to you now and I spoke out initially was because this unholy silence that has been in the church hurts people. And we have a responsibility as pastors of souls to minister to those souls entrusted to our care. And ignoring them is betrayal of Christ himself.
Father Jeffrey Farrell, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Today's program produced by Gary Scott with Christian Bordahl and Karen Radziner. Our technical director is Mike Newport. For more information about To the Point or to email us, visit kcrw.com/To the Point. I'm Orman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.